Hello, my name is Zoe. Welcome to The Dopest, a podcast about navigating and enjoying the cannabis landscape in Canada. If you're hearing this, then we did it. Recreational cannabis is now legal in Canada, and that is something to celebrate. 95 years of prohibition, generations of civil disobedience, institutionalized racism, and a continued shadow of stigma. Cannabis has, until now, been a catalyst for so much wrong. But our federal government has succeeded in making a change. This is an important chapter that we welcome, but by no means is the end of the story. Over the next several weeks, we'll have conversations with individuals throughout the cannabis industry, from lawyers to activists, artists, and entrepreneurs, to keep you informed and updated. For now, we're going to kick this off with a conversation I had with Jack Lloyd. He's a cannabis lawyer and editor for Green Candy Press, the world's largest publisher of cannabis literature. Jack and I had a great conversation about legal cannabis 101, some things you'll need to know if you want to grow, purchase, and consume cannabis now that the law has changed. Enjoy. So let's get started. So first of all, today marks the realization of a change in Canadian law that you have been working towards for years. So how does it feel to see the legalization of recreational cannabis?
It's very exciting to see. It's something that I think as Canadians, we should be very proud of. We should also recognize the many years of hard work that were put in by lawyers and activists. Other than I'm just a small part of a very big puzzle, but certainly we should be very proud of ourselves. There's lots of work that needs to be done still, but overall, I'm very excited to see legal cannabis and for consenting adult Canadians to be able to share up to 30 grams of interesting cannabis strains with one another is pretty incredible.
Beautiful. So personally, like, what led you down the path of becoming a cannabis lawyer and legalization activist?
Well, I worked in the cannabis industry and became involved with the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Canada. So I volunteered and still do volunteer with them. And I worked as an editor for a publishing company that does books about the cannabis plant as well. I'm a lifelong believer in the cannabis plant. And so essentially, I came from the cannabis community and cannabis industry. And at a certain point, I felt that I might be more useful to our community as a lawyer rather than just a political advocate or a publisher or editor. So I went to law school and I became a lawyer, and that's what I do now.
That's incredible. You were an activist and you're like, clearly to take the next step, I'm going to go to law school, get the education. That's incredible. I know a lot of stoners that wouldn't take that, that trip. What would you say were some of the kind of key movements in the legitimacy and legalization of cannabis in order to kind of push this forward?
Well, we've had 95 years of prohibition, and there's been a host of different attempts to dismantle that. And I think really the most effective has simply been for the cannabis community to be a committed and resolute community of people that are otherwise law-abiding. And I think eventually courts got pretty tired of dealing with people so long as there weren't other offenses involved. I think that's crucial. But ultimately, we also stand on the shoulders of a great many activists and lawyers and cannabis community members, Mark Emery, Jody Emery, Dana Larson, certainly Alan Young and Paul Lewin, Kirk Tousaw, and
other
John
lawyers.
Conroy, certainly other lawyers, yeah. And the big fights that they've had over the last 25, 30 years, obviously the Parker decision is where legal cannabis was born, essentially. The Ontario Court of Appeal decision is, even rereading it recently, is it's a beautiful decision and is very firm in the fact that a sick person has a right to a constitutionally valid program. And the program has to be constitutionally valid in order to prevent that sick person's Section 7 charter interest from being infringed. I don't want to get boring legalese.
No, fantastic.
Ultimately, that's sort of the core of where all of this came from. And then there's a what lawyers in this community would call a litany of litigation ensued that has resulted in a situation where we're hopeful that sick people can have reliable and reasonable access to medical cannabis. And very soon, it looks as if non-medical users of cannabis can also benefit from the foundation laid by this history of litigation. So it's very interesting because it's legislation that was sort of dragged, kicking and screaming by the courts into the 21st century. And as of today, cannabis is legal recreationally in this country. And that's something I'm certainly very pleased to see.
Pleased and proud. So now that cannabis is legal, what do our listeners need to know about their rights as consumers, as recreational consumers, the basics?
Well, the basics of a recreational cannabis consumer, I suppose the first and foremost is you are bound by certain rules in regards to where you can use your medicine, and those rules vary across Canada. So if we were to look at Ontario, some very sensible amendments to Bill 174, which is the provincial legislation. So Caroline Mulroney has tabled really good changes, essentially, to that piece of law that allow you to use cannabis anywhere that tobacco is lawfully used.
And so, Smoke-Free Ontario Act, correct?
Correct, yeah. So these amendments are crucial in basically saying, okay, we recognize that the situation that we're creating in the original iteration of Bill 174 would have made a situation in which average Ontarians certainly wouldn't be able to use this legal product. So you can use it now. So that's very exciting. Of course, the law of nuisance still applies to you. So you may well see some difficulty if you are smoking within 5 meters of a store, a building's entrance, and things of that nature. But overall, I suspect that that amendment in particular has cured a lot of the potential problems with the bill in Ontario. Other provinces are going to see, you know, here and there issues. Total bans on consumption inevitably would be, in my view, unenforceable. It's very difficult for a cop to take that step. They're busy enough. But overall, you can possess, if you're a recreational user, I suppose the important thing to recognize between recreational and medical is that there's no constitutional right, there's no mandated right for you to possess or use your cannabis. So recreational users have less rights in relation to the cannabis plant than medical users do. Mm. And medical users, of course, can carry this is interesting. So your average recreational user can carry up to 30 grams of illicit cannabis. That's fine. A medical user can carry 150 grams of medical cannabis, and they can also purchase an additional 30 grams. So they can now carry, as of October 17th, a medical user with a valid permit can have 180 grams on them.
Is that regardless of the prescription? Because I carry a prescription card, but the limit is 5 grams.
So your maximum, so if you were to 5 times 30 days in a month, means that your maximum is 150 grams.
Got it.
But at its core, that's where it maxes out. So even if your prescription was 20 grams a day, it maxes out at 150 grams when you're in your bag that's with you so that you have a reliable access to that. Mm-hmm. But Health Canada now says that, in fact, you could attend at a store and purchase an additional 30 grams and that would still be licit. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. There's no barrier to how much you can have in your home so long as it's licit. So if you were stocking up, you could attend at your local licensed cannabis shop, which we won't see that in Ontario until April 2019, but you could attend there. You could purchase 30 grams. Return home, drop it off in a secure location, go back to the store, purchase another 30 grams. So you can only purchase 30 grams in one setting. The same for a medical user. If the mail order program wasn't able to get you your medicine, you could lawfully attend at the recreational dispensary. You could purchase 30 grams, return home, drop it off, go back, purchase another 30 grams. And you could do that up to 180 grams. Huh. So it sounds a bit ridiculous.
A little bit.
I don't anticipate that. I think if you were to view this from a 5-year perspective, I don't anticipate that rules like that will last particularly long. Yeah. But I suppose what the final interesting point is there's no limit on how much you can have in your home. So you could have a million tons of cannabis in your home.
That's incredible.
So long as you don't possess it for the purpose of trafficking.
I see.
But you can't, as soon as you leave your house, you've got to only have 30 grams. And then I think what's most fascinating about it is you could have, you could grow 4 plants in your backyard, harvest them, store however much they produced. And if you wanted to share 30 grams of it with a friend who's also a consenting adult, you could share that with them and just give them 30 grams and they could give you 30 grams of cannabis that they grew. You could sample each other's wares. Before October 17th, we would call that drug trafficking. So this is that's kind of, wonderful change in our law as well.
Now, just a question about those limits. So currently, the only place to buy cannabis in Ontario is online. So does the same kind of function work where it's like you can only purchase in one sitting, I suppose, 30 grams, and you'd have to, I guess, log back on to your account on the Ontario Cannabis Store website? Do the same rules apply to the government websites as they would to a bricks and mortar store?
Yes.
Okay. Just wanted to check.
Yeah, and you'll need to sign for it. We know what the law looks like. We don't know what their user interface will look like. I'm hopeful that they do a good job of it. They recently made some statement that as long as cannabis isn't like some pop star's cosmetic brand, then we won't have any issues with people trying to order it through their site. And I shook my head a little bit because I'm not sure if they realize what 12 million interested customers might look like to
them. Is
their...
that it?
you have to be in Ontario.
A resident
to
purchase of the from, province, right. Got it.
The Ontario Cannabis Store needs to be
fair enough.
Delivered. And I think that they aren't, if they're shipping cosmetics, no one in particular needs to sign for that.
Right.
Whereas with cannabis, there's a tracking system that applies to it that I'm not sure if they've thought through the administrative work that's required to do that properly.
It's, can't imagine they have.
It strikes me as a daunting task. So I'm sure they're going to have their hands full. And hopefully they do a great job.
Yeah.
We have an enviable system here.
We have faith in the system. just along those lines, do you foresee like any trouble areas for consumers who may still be at risk of being charged? Or is this kind of, we've opened the gates?
it's going to be a difficult determination in regards to what the law calls licit and illicit cannabis. So If it can be proven that you are in possession of illicit cannabis, and a great way for them to find illicit cannabis is if you've got a high potency extract that was produced using an organic solvent like butane or something like that, that's not lawful under the act. So if you don't have medical authorization to possess it, then it's going to be deemed illicit. Even if you purchase 30 grams and you bought a butane canister, and again, I don't recommend this, but had you done that, that's unlawful. And you could be charged with possession of illicit cannabis. You could be charged with a form of trafficking offense if you shared it. And you might be charged with production of a controlled substance as well. So, there's still risks.
Yeah, that's very interesting. To get a little bit more technical, let's say you don't purchase a carrier agent, but you somehow acquire something to make like a carrier-free concentrate. So pure heat and pressure applied to the cannabis flower, would that still be considered illicit?
No. So that would be, say, a rosin press or something like that, which is great. When you say carrier, I think it's important to differentiate because a carrier in this context would be, say, a fatty substance like butter or milk, because the cannabinoids are soluble in fat.
Right. Food grade.
Precisely. Got so it. That's not unlawful. So if you made your own cookies and they were at your house, that's not unlawful.
Okay.
But if you used, I think the word, maybe a more appropriate word in regards to the production of high potency concentrates that extract cannabinoids, you would be looking for a hydrocarbon-based solvent, something
right.
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, okay.
And so, and again, that and I think like there's a tendency in law and in the media to portray extraction techniques like that as dangerous and things like that. But those are the same, you know, regulation would solve any danger element to that. And they're the same techniques that are used in pretty much every other industry. So the perfume industry uses solvents to extract various terpenes and alkaloid various chemicals from plant products. So it's not unique to the cannabis industry. It's unique, I think, in that cannabis is unique, mm-hmm. but that process isn't new. That's been around for hundreds of years. So I'm always troubled by the fear mongering that gets placed mm-hmm. onto the cannabis community. It's kind of surreal. So mm-hmm. it's not some foreign substance. It's the same as plenty of plant extract products people use every day. It's just that because it's not regulated, people are doing it on their own without mm-hmm. perhaps without proper supervision, without regulation and things of that nature. And that can lead to certain issues, but that's, I digress.
We'll get there 6 months from now, maybe.
Yeah.
So who's allowed to work in cannabis and are they at any risk? And I mean, from like any angle of the industry, from bud tenders to cultivators, farmers, who is allowed into this industry? Is anybody allowed to cross over from gray to the legal market?
Oh, I think the dominant narrative is that, yes, you can cross over from black or gray market to the legal market, and you're encouraged to do so. Whether you pass a security clearance to become a licensed producer or whatever iteration of a licensed producer exists under the Cannabis Act as it goes forward, the answer is maybe. To become a micro producer, micro license, or a micro cultivation holder, they're encouraging large MMAR growers and large ACMPR growers to make those applications and to seek licensing and to become little LPs. And I think that's a smart decision to make if you want to sort of, again, participate 5 years from now when things are going to look very different. I encourage people to do that all the time. Like if you're a bud tender working at an unlicensed dispensary, then you face the same jeopardy you face previously. You might be charged with a very serious drug trafficking offense. You know, I think a lot of really serious questions remain to be asked about whether or not a mail order only system for medical cannabis is sufficient to help critically and chronically ill Canadians who rely on cannabis medicine. The consistent narrative from that community is that they rely on these compassion clubs to exist. So that fight will continue as the government's program gets better. I'm hopeful that we won't need to have that fight any longer. But ultimately, in Ontario, as an example, if the dispensary shuts down on October 16th, then they have the opportunity to become licensed in the province of Ontario. In fact, Carolyn Mulroney has been quite clear that they support small business, they support entrepreneurship, and that they're not that interested in a finding of guilt, a charge, or a conviction under the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, but they are very interested in a charge, a finding of guilt, or a conviction under the Cannabis Act, and in fact, or the provincial iteration of it. And in fact, if you are charged under that act, that may well be a barrier to participation in the licit market in Ontario. So they've been pretty clear that if you play ball and stop by October 17th, they're interested in licensing you. And so mostly I'm hopeful that lots of the institutional knowledge and know-how and community experience and spirit that comes from the existing cannabis community, that it can be licensed and can continue and become even stronger going forward in Ontario, certainly, and all across Canada.
Do you think that the decision to accept private retail into the market as of next April 2019 had anything to do with this kind of pre-existing community, or is there kind of an unknown area that we don't see as the public?
I think the PC government ideologically saw what was going on and said, this makes quite a bit of sense, and recognize that there are thousands of people working in this industry currently and paying their rent and not being on public assistance as a result of jobs from this craft industry. And I think that they listened. I was yelling it from the rooftop. So I'm very hopeful that they did hear us. It remains to be seen what it looks like. But, you know, if they stay true to their values of supporting small business, like there's an opportunity for hundreds, if not thousands, of really interesting and wonderful and unique cannabis industry participants to be legal.
What prospects do you see for people working or even investing in legal cannabis to have easy entry into the United States? The $64,000 question.
So there's no clear answer on that front. And again, I'm not providing any legal advice in regards to this. If you had a serious concern, I would advise you to speak with an immigration lawyer. In my view, it's an overblown concern. I've represented thousands of people charged with far more serious cannabis-related offenses than anything, anyone, or any, you know, any allegation that you worked at a shop or anything like that. And very rarely do any of my clients have any issues at the border. It's a crapshoot. Ultimately, the sheer act of having interacted with the cannabis plant at any time in your life could very well act as a barrier to entry to the United States. And it's not like we've seen this mass prevention of Canadians from visiting the USA. So,
do you see that getting any worse with Trump in office or any of the restrictions that Pence wants to put on cannabis in the United States? I mean, I only ask because it's so prevalent in the news, but it does look like fake news.
It's not fake news. It's always been, right? Nothing has changed. Right. That's been the same for 95 years, right? It's just that I just think that border agents are busy enough that if suddenly they're going to focus on every person that's ever interacted with the cannabis plant, then it's going to close the border. I just don't see it happening. In my opinion, it's not as dire a concern as the media has portrayed it.
Good to know.
And I'm very hopeful that I'm not proven wrong. And if I am, then hire a good immigration lawyer and follow their advice.
Fair. So going forward, what further policy do you see pushing forward as a cannabis activist?
Now, in-person retail access is currently only possible through illegal compassion clubs. And that's not going to change at a particularly rapid rate. Mm-hmm. It's going to happen. Stores eventually will be open and ready to operate. Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, PEI, they are ready to go. Newfoundland as well. They've done a really good job on the East Coast at getting their provincial replacements. Now, I think that those provincially owned and operated replacements should be coupled with medical compassion clubs, simply because certain patients don't want to access their medicine in the same place that someone accesses their recreational cannabis. I think it's fair. But at its core, the fight is going to continue for certain individuals who require in-person access when stores are not open and are not operating, simply because the consensus amongst patients is that the mail order program is not working for them. I think that fight will continue. Access to a variety of cannabis derivative medicines is going to be a live issue and a big fight going forward. So edibles, high potency extracts, a host of extract products, topical cannabis products, all of these are available through the gray market. They're not available through the licit market. And there's a host of people that rely on them and use them for a variety of medical ailments. And they're not even getting per se high from these products, but they're finding that they provide them with a great deal of medical benefit. And so that fight is going to continue because if you shut down every single in-person access point for those people and you start shutting down all of the gray market online access points, then you're going to essentially create a situation in which sick people cannot access their medicine. So that's probably going to be the fight for a little while longer, the hope being that the legislation loosens and more industry participants are licensed. So gray and black market people are given rules to follow and they follow them, and we have a bigger, more diverse industry. that would solve a lot of it. But that fight's going to continue, certainly.
Mm-hmm. For sure. What do you think the long-term impact of legalization will be? Where is Canada 20 years from now as a country with legal access to cannabis versus a Canada without?
Well, I think we're going to see a wonderful industry emerge. Well, it already has, certainly, but a resilient and world-leading industry will develop in this country. And I think we should be really proud of that. In fact, Canada has been a world leader in cannabis genetics for 20 years, but we weren't allowed to brag about it. So we have the opportunity now, certainly, to talk to our other friends about it. I think we should be proud of that. I think it's going to be an economic boon, certainly. It's going to generate a lot of tax revenue. I'm hopeful that it employs a lot of people and employs a lot of people in a way that they don't suddenly get everything taken away from them and thrown in jail. Mm-hmm. I think I'm just hopeful that people have good jobs that they can rely on, they can raise families with and pay taxes with and be what the cannabis community always has been, which is otherwise law-abiding. Well, you know, there's no otherwise. We're just law-abiding now. Yeah. So that's really ultimately the goal. I'm hopeful that other countries follow our lead and we see cultural shift. There's still places on planet Earth where people are executed over the cannabis plant, and it's certainly... we're very fortunate to have the laws that we do in this country, although I'm hopeful soon we'll remove, you know, no jail for cannabis. Certainly that's vitally important, and mm-hmm. other countries are going to hopefully follow suit. We're the first and the largest to do it federally, so at least the first G7, and I think it'll create perhaps a tide that other countries won't be able to stop this from happening, which would be good globally, certainly. So I guess for a 20-year vision is one of hope, I suppose. That's what I could say.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much. Not only for like educating me and our listeners about what we can now do with cannabis, but for all the incredible work that you've done and will continue to do.
I am the baby lawyer in this movement, so I don't take any credit for that.
It's important to have baby lawyers. We like the baby lawyers, the passionate
kind of you to
baby
say.
Lawyers. It's incredible, and I only hope that our listeners can go out and get educated like you did.
I hope that they have a very smooth transition mm-hmm. to the wonderful world of legal cannabis. And if you have any questions, give me a call. But hopefully, you never have any issue whatsoever with illicit cannabis. And you look back at prohibition as some kind of curious period of our history that is best forgotten.
Indeed. The emerald past and the golden future.
Hey,
Jack,
I
thank you
it.
So
oh.
much. So that was my conversation with Jack Lloyd. It's a very interesting, almost encyclopedic knowledge of Canadian cannabis law, past, present, potentially the future. Some really interesting takeaways for you to note. Currently, you can carry 30 grams of dried licit cannabis on you. You're able to share that cannabis with another adult. You can purchase cannabis right now at OCS.ca, that's the government website, and you can grow your own. Lots of great books out there. You can check out my recommendations on our Instagram page. That's at the dopest, at THEDOPIST. I thought it was really interesting that you can make your own edibles with your dried flower. You can make butters or oils. You can even make solventless extracts. I think that's really fascinating. So hashes, certain kinds of extracts and concentrates. So stay tuned. We're definitely going to dig more into what you can DIY at home with your legal flower. And that got me really excited about next week's conversation. I'm going to sit down with Tyler James from Cannabis Amnesty and Sensible Ontario. We're going to discuss the importance of assisting the dismissal of minor cannabis drug charges in Canada, which is a very important ongoing battle for us here and, of course, in the United States. So stay tuned. And in the meantime, if you like what you're hearing, then remember your cannabis etiquette and puff, puff, pass this podcast on to a friend. The Dopest is a production of Weedbox, produced and edited by Noah Snyderman of Voice Magic. Original music by John Mavro. The show is researched and edited by myself, Zoe Brownstone, and Noah Snyderman. You can find us on Instagram at The Dopest. That's at THEDOPIST. Until then, we'll be back next week.